Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Well, hello. This is Harriet Hegeman, and I'm in for John Vecchione today, and I'm going to be visiting about a presidential executive order, number 14008, that was issued on January 27th, 2021, called Tackling the Climate Crisis at Home and Abroad. Most specifically, I'm going to refer to Section 216, which talks about conserving our nation's lands and waters. And I just want to read for you a real brief paragraph of what exactly the point of this particular executive order is, or this particular section, and then I'm going to provide some additional information about what the new administration is doing in relation to water and natural resource issues. According to Section 216, it states that the Secretary of Interior, in consultation with the Secretary of Ag and the Secretary of Commerce and the Chair of the CEQ and the heads of other relevant agencies, shall submit a report to the task force within 90 days of the date of this order recommending steps that the United States should take, working with state, local, tribal, and territorial governments, agricultural and forest landowners, fishermen, and other key stakeholders to achieve the goal of conserving at least 30% of our lands and waters by 2030. This is called the 30 by 30 regulation or executive order. And in that introductory paragraph, it talked about a report being submitted to the task force. There is a task force that was also put together by this executive order of quite a few different agency heads, as you can imagine, the Attorney General, Secretary of Interior, Secretary of Agriculture, et cetera, et cetera. And the group that has been put together has actually issued a report pursuant to Section 216. It came out last month. It's called Conserving and Restoring America the Beautiful, and that's how it is referred to in a variety of different publications that have come out. To give you an idea of what the intent of all of this is, I'll just quickly read the introductory paragraph, and what it states is that it is a letter to America that states, as we write this, America is engaged in an all-hands-on-deck effort to defeat a deadly pandemic and tackle the climate crisis. We are proud to be part of a team that is delivering relief to families in need, helping businesses weather economic storm, and ensuring that millions of Americans receive vaccine shots each day. If that gives you an idea of the scattershot approach to this particular program, then I think that you're probably on the right track. I'm just going to go through a couple of very important key points here so that you understand the magnitude of what this 30 by 30 program is and what it will do.
Can I ask one question, Harriet? Yeah. You talk about 30% by 2030. What are we at now? Are we at like 29.5% now? And so this is just like a 0.5% increase in federal lands, or are we at something well below 30% now?
Well, it is interesting, Mark, that you asked that question, because there's still a lot of unknowns. Although the report has been issued, the report has no details whatsoever. It has a lot of nice words and a lot of nice descriptions about America the Beautiful and access to natural resources and to parks and things like that. But there's very little detail that has actually been provided. What I do know is that it seeks to lock up 30% of all lands and waters in the United States, again, by 2030. Private lands are not exempt from this initiative, and hundreds of millions of additional acres currently managed for multiple use under the Multiple Use and Sustained Yield Act or economic development are actually threatened by this initiative. The federal government already manages 640 million acres of land, and the vast majority of that is in the West. And as someone who's from Wyoming, where 48% of our surface estate is owned by the federal government, I can tell you that that has a significant impact on what we can and cannot do in terms of economic development and providing resources for our citizens. There are more than 750 million acres of federal waters that are already locked up. But what's interesting is under this 30 by 30 program, they are claiming, and what they're seeking to do is claim an additional 681 million acres of additional land and water to be protected under the federal government's control. So that's the goal. We have
six. So that sounds like you said 681 million additional acres. Well, that was more than the number that you said we're currently under. So it sounds like we're maybe under 15% now of federal land. They're looking to more than double the number of acres under federal control. That's unbelievable. That's like taking that would be like taking the whole state of Alaska out of production again or something like that. I mean, that's unbelievable.
It's absolutely correct. The federal government already manages 640 million acres of land, and they've already protected 750 million acres of federal waters. They're seeking an additional 681 million acres under this particular program. Now, what's really interesting is when you get into the meat of this, when you get into the guts of what it is they're trying to do, and you open the hood and start pulling out the wires and things, what you find is that even their own numbers don't add up. So one of the claims they say is that we are losing, whatever that means, approximately a football field to development every 30 seconds. So they're saying that every 30 seconds in the United States, we've got a football field of land that is being developed. What's interesting about that, though, is if you start doing the math, that's a total of 11 million acres that would be developed by the year 2030. So we're talking about something that is on the order of magnitude above that. That by their own admission and their own calculations, we've got about 11 million acres that would be developed over the next 9 years. Yet they claim that the federal government needs to step in and essentially take control of 680 million acres of land. So I think that you can see what this is about. And really, it's an enormous, enormous federal land grab, both land and water, because they talk about both. There is absolutely no statutory or constitutional authority for the president, the Department of Interior, or the Department of Ag, for that matter, to set aside and permanently conserve or reserve 30% of all land and water in the United States. The only authority that they have is through this executive order. And Mark, you and I spend an awful lot of our lives fighting what we believe is the administrative overreach associated with guidance documents, executive orders, and those sorts of things. So,
so if the number doesn't come from Congress, Harriet, where does it come from?
It came, none of this authority came from Congress. And in fact, what's very interesting is if you look at the Wilderness Act, in terms of designating lands as wilderness, the only entity that has the authority to do that is Congress. Yet the way that they're writing this 30 by 30 program is that they actually intend to go down the wilderness route and severely restrict and limit access and use of these lands. Now, they talk all flowery and they talk about how there are people within the inner cities that have to walk more than 10 minutes to visit a park. And so they want to address those things. But that isn't really where this kind of program is going to be implemented. This program is going to largely affect your Western states because it isn't going to be in Washington, D.C. that they literally go in and condemn one of these buildings and build a park. That's not reasonable. It's not rational. It's not going to happen. So it's going to be additional lands taken out of production and use in the Western United States.
But why 30%? Why not 20%? Why not 40%? I mean, where does this number come from?
I think because it rhymes.
Thin air?
Yeah, I think because it rhymes. It's a 30.
Maybe because of the ESPN 30 for 30, a documentary series. They were inspired.
They were watching TV one day and they thought, you know, that's a good idea. But here's what's also important is they have admitted this is just the start. Their next program is 50 by 50. So by the year
holy 50, cow, 50,
by the year 50-50, what?
Wait, 50-50 or 2050?
Excuse me, 2050, not 50-50. By the year 2050. The goal of these folks is to actually set aside and preserve, although none of that terminology is defined, 50% of our surface and our water resources in government, federal government ownership and control by 2050. So it's a matter of just rhymes. These are totally random numbers, totally arbitrary. But I think something that is very, very important for people to understand when talking about this is that the federal government is already incapable of managing the resources that it already has. For example, both the National Park Service and the U.S. Forest Service have over $11 billion in maintenance backlogs. In other words, they're closing rest areas. They are not hiring employees. They're not maintaining their roads. They're not providing the the access and the trails and things like that to the lands that they already have. The federal government, the Forest Service and Park Service especially, are already failing to manage the resources that they have. There's no reason to expand that. And there's another important issue, and especially we've seen it the last couple of years, and it's the catastrophic forest fires we've seen out west. California, Colorado, Wyoming, Montana, Utah, these states have actually just gone up in smoke, and they've suffered through conflagrations. If you want more information about that, you can go to a blog that is on the NCLA website that I wrote in October of 2020. It's called,
and that website is nclalegal.org, just so folks know, nclalegal.org, the New Civil Liberties Alliance.
Yes, thank you, Mark. And you can look under my name, and I did a blog about bad regulations destroy our environment, and it gives statistics about the amount of forest fires that we lost just last year, in large part because of bad management of our forests by, again, the National Forest Service related to a roadless rule that was adopted in the year 2001. So when I go through this report, I see references to low-income communities. I see references to tribes and tribal lands and the impacts on them. But the reality is, the more land that the federal government owns, the poorer your community is, because it doesn't allow for economic development. So the irony is, you read all of the fluff in this report about how we're going to serve underserved communities and we're going to provide for economic development. When the federal government comes in with this kind of a program, the very purpose of it is to stifle economic development and to prevent us from being able to have good paying jobs. It also dramatically increases the cost associated with building materials, for example. If we are not allowed to access and log our National Forest Service lands, which is the reason that they were created, then we don't have that resource to go home. So there are lots of consequences.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. Mark Chenoweth and guest host Harriet Hageman here with you. And for our last segment, Harriet, I wanted to talk a little bit about the COVID vaccine. That's something I don't think John and I have talked about on this show, but there have been some recent developments that are, I think, a little bit concerning with the direction that this is taking. And let me, before I say anything else, let me make clear that I am not saying that people should not take the vaccine. In fact, I have been fully vaccinated myself with the Moderna vaccine. Others in my immediate family have been fully vaccinated with other COVID vaccines. I am not anti-vax in any way, shape, or form. But let me tell you what I think is a little bit problematic or concerning with the way that the federal government and the Biden administration are going about trying to mandate this vaccine. So there's a federal statute for emergency use authorization, and this is what President Trump took advantage of when he did Operation Warp Speed and promised the major vaccine manufacturers like Pfizer that the federal government would purchase millions of doses, tens of millions of doses of the vaccine if they were successful in producing one. And then the FDA was able to put these through a quicker than normal approval process under this emergency use authorization statute. But one of the things that's different and importantly different about vaccines that are approved under the emergency use authorization is that everyone understands that these are a little bit experimental. That doesn't mean that it won't be a successful experiment. It doesn't mean that science won't eventually show us that, hey, these are every bit as good as advertised. And they seem to be fantastic. Both Pfizer and Moderna seem to be giving us in the mid 90 percentile protection for the vaccines. But as part of that emergency use authorization, you have to have informed consent from anyone who takes the vaccine. So if you go to a vaccine clinic like I did, and you go there, they give you material. You're supposed to understand about the vaccine, about the risk that you're running getting the vaccine, about hopefully about the risks that you're avoiding by getting the vaccine as well, because this isn't all cost, right? There's tremendous benefit to the vaccine as well. But you have to make that decision, right? It's supposed to be an informed consent regime. And in fact, federal law prohibits mandating emergency use authorization vaccines for anyone. So when I hear that schools are mandating that students get vaccines before they come back in the fall, when I hear that universities are mandating that faculty get a vaccine before they return to campus or teach classes in the fall, it makes me very concerned, because under the emergency use authorization statute, that is prohibited. You cannot mandate that anyone get an emergency use authorization vaccine. State law cannot supersede the federal law on this point. There's a federal supremacy clause in the Constitution. If you have a federal statute that puts into place this kind of experimental regime, and that part of the approval, part of the package deal, if you will, when the FDA approves an emergency use authorization vaccine, is that they cannot then mandate anyone to get the vaccine. And that doesn't mean that only the federal government can't mandate it. The states cannot mandate it either. So this point has not been widely advertised, I think, or not widely enough advertised. And it sounds like the FDA may be on the verge of approving one or more vaccines on a non-emergency basis. That is, giving full approval to the Pfizer vaccine, for example, perhaps the Moderna vaccine as well. I'm not sure what the status is on that. But what I hear is that part of the impetus for the approval of the vaccine before September is precisely so that schools can mandate that students get the vaccine, and universities can mandate that teachers and faculty get the vaccine. And I don't know about you, Harriet, but that seems to put the cart before the horse to me. It seems to me that, yeah.
That was the question I was just going to ask. That doesn't seem to make sense, because that's an extraneous reason for approving the vaccine, rather than approving the vaccine based upon its constituencies and its effectiveness and its safety and all of those things. If it's still a political decision, it seems that it's violating the very spirit of the law, if not the law itself. The purpose of this was to address an emergency. If there's no longer that emergency, number one, and number two, you still have the concern about some of the safety issues, that sort of thing. We shouldn't be doing it. We should not be approving it for political reasons.
Well, and I don't know. So my understanding is that the way that the approval process works is that there is a panel of experts, and these are medical experts. This isn't this. I don't want to suggest this is a situation like we had with the CDC, where the teachers' unions were weighing in and encouraging the CDC not to say it was safe to go back to school, but because I don't think that's the situation. When the FDA approves something, there is a panel of experts who approve it. But I do think that the question at least needs to be asked: why? What's the rush? What's the hurry? You have already approved it for emergency use authorization. It's available. It's out there. If people want the vaccine, they can get it. I think we're to the point in most states. I know the state where I'm living, Virginia, has been extremely slow on the uptake. Everybody in my family in Arizona, Indiana, and South Carolina got vaccinated before I did, and I was supposedly near the front of the line in Virginia. But it sounds like in most states, most people can get the vaccine now if they want to get it. That it's been opened up pretty widely. So what's the rush to a more general approval? And if the rush to the general approval is so that you can mandate it, then that just seems like a mentality of coercion. And my fear is that some of the folks on the panels who approve these things at the FDA, sure, they're immunology experts, and they know a lot about public health and so forth. But I worry that they may be, you know, you may be getting the cheerleaders for vaccines as the ones who are on board with approving these things. And I am concerned that once these things leave the emergency use authorization sort of rubric, that we're going to see a massive effort to mandate this vaccine. Now, it's not that I think that necessarily you should never be able to mandate a vaccine. The measles vaccine, mumps, rubella, diphtheria, right? There's lots of tetanus. There's lots of vaccines that are mandatory for kids before they go to school, precisely to prevent a pandemic. But one of the things that or outbreaks of things like measles that we have pretty well under control, as long as people continue to get vaccinated. But if they don't, then we lose the herd immunity that we have built up for some of those diseases. But what I'm concerned about, Harriet, is if these things go off of emergency use authorization and you start having, whether it's states or localities or university administrations or local school districts or whatever, mandate these vaccinations, they may not take into consideration all of the various factors that they need to be taking into consideration. For example, I'm aware of one university that is planning to require all faculty to get vaccinated before the fall. And I'm aware of another university that currently the order is that every student has to get vaccinated before the fall. And the problem with this is,
it's regardless of whether they've already had coronavirus and have natural immunities. Then is that
that's exactly right, Harry. That's exactly what I was going to say. Is there's a cohort of folks out there who have already had COVID, they've recovered from it, and they have natural antibodies as a result of having recovered from the COVID disease. And requiring those folks to have a vaccine is particularly problematic. It's not just that they won't benefit from the vaccine, because it's if you already have the antibodies, whatever additional value you would get from the vaccine is going to be pretty slim. You already have the protection that you need. So the vaccine isn't going to help you. And more importantly, it's not going to help anyone else, right? So if the rationale behind mandatory vaccines is, well, it's not just about you, we need to protect the people who can't get it, or we need to protect the other people around you. Well, the other people around you are already protected. If you've had COVID, you've recovered, you have the antibodies in your system, you are not a threat to them anymore. You are protecting them every bit as much as if you've had the vaccine. And some of the literature I've seen, Harriet, suggests maybe you're even more protected because the vaccines target this spike protein and give you protection from that, which is one component of the COVID virus. But if you have natural immunity, if you've had it and recovered, then there's a full spectrum sort of protection against other aspects of the virus, not just the spike protein. So you may actually be better off if you are in that recovered state in terms of your the risk of harming any third parties. Go ahead.
Mark, we have examples of that in the past, and the Spanish flu is one of them. And we know that the Spanish flu was truly a horrific pandemic in the early part of the last century. My grandfather was one who got the Spanish flu, was deathly ill. He recovered. His first wife passed away, but he recovered. He lived to 103 years old, and I'm not sure that the man was ever sick again. So there are definitely immunities associated with having these diseases and recovering from them. And one of my concerns is when you mandate a vaccine like this, are you somehow going to be affecting or interrupting that? And why not use those natural immunities? Because I do think, as you've said a couple of times, that they may provide more benefits than the vaccine does.
Well, that's right. And we should really be focusing on the concept of medical necessity here, right? The Hippocratic Oath is first do no harm. And if somebody already has the immunity, then there is a harm potential as well. Because if someone, you know, that one of the reasons they ask you, if you're somebody who has had the vaccine, you know, when you stand in line, they come and they ask you that, you know, have you had all these COVID symptoms in the last week or two? The reason they're asking you that is because if you currently have COVID, they don't want to give you the vaccine because it can do negative things to your body. And the same thing is true if you've recovered from COVID recently. The vaccine might have negative impacts on your body. So if there's no medical necessity for the vaccine, then I really don't want to see these states or localities or universities ordering people to get it. I'm sure we'll have more to say on this topic. Thank you, Harriet, for being with us as the guest host today. It was terrific to have you on board. Look forward to having John with us back with us next week on Administrative Static.